Hello and welcome to Bread and Rosaries, the one true UK-based leftist Christian podcast, except no imposters. I'm Ben Molyneux-Hedington, and I'm joined by Adam Spears and Luca von Badass. Say hello, Adam.
Hello, Adam.
Say hello, Lou.
What happened?
I don't know. I was expecting you to say hello.
I said say hello, Lou.
Sorry, I think it froze. Hello, Lou.
We were doing so well at that intro, and then I was just, because I'm looking at the notes, I'm not even looking at the screen, so then I was like, what the hell is going on? Why is, have Lou and I fallen out already? Like, Happy New Year, both of you. Did either of you celebrate at all?
No, I stayed up and made fudge.
No, I went to bed at 8:30.
Wow.
Half eight, that's even earlier than I went to bed. That's quite impressive. Were you like ill, or were you just like, fuck this?
I was kind of a bit of both, actually. And I've been reading The Body Keeps the Score, and I wanted to have a nice time in with Bessel van der Kolk, doing Trauma, all of that. So that's how I celebrated my New Year's Eve. It was very earnest.
Lovely. Oh, well, we'll have to talk about The Body Keeps the Score at some point. It's been a while since I've read it, but fascinating stuff. Adam, you are the only one on the podcast who stayed up late for it, you party animal.
I honestly don't really care for the new year, but I had promised fudge as a present, so I had to make some.
Did you realise you'd stayed up for the new year, or did you simply happen to be awake at midnight?
I am basically a vampire, so I'm normally awake at midnight.
We are going to talk about something that I think a lot of people would have associated New Year with, rather than fudge, although I personally prefer fudge, which is alcohol today. So if you're... by the time this comes out, we'll have been a long way away from New Year, but we're recording it quite early, so still quite close to it. But if you're sat listening to this with a hangover, maybe you'll have to rethink your life choices in light of today's episode, or maybe not. We'll see how it goes. But we're going to start with our regular segment, What Else Is On My Mind Grapes?
What else is on my mind grapes?
And what is on pretty much all of our mind grapes is Pelé and the Pope have quite recently passed away. The Pope, what's the word we have to use? Ex-Pope is wrong, right? Pope.
Pope Emeritus.
Emeritus, yeah.
Yeah, not Francis, not the current Pope.
Yeah. A bad Pope, not okay Pope, not to, you know, get away, let's give away our take.
I mean, okay is, yeah, I mean, Francis is still, you know, he's still Pope of the Catholic Church. I think people often think of him as being some, like, super cool kind of guy, and in some ways he is, but, like, he's still a Catholic and still the Pope, so.
Yeah, I mean, in the history of popes, he's relatively good, but, like, that's not a particularly ringing endorsement.
Not a high bar, is it? No.
Yeah. Lou, you were very excited to talk about the Pope's body.
Yeah, I'm really interested into that. Very interested in the Pope Emeritus's body. No, just because I'm kind of fascinated about the whole lying in state thing. So both Benedict and Pelé were both lying in state. Pelé was in the big stadium, I think, lying in state.
Yeah.
Open casket.
Yeah, that was amazing.
It was pretty amazing.
Not Pelé, was it?
And the Pope as well.
Was closed for Pelé.
The casket was closed. Oh, well.
I think so. I could be wrong. I mean, it is odd that it would be, but then he is in an open stadium, so.
Yeah, true. But he did get, I'll talk about his burial in a bit, because that is something else entirely. The Pope, he was kind of propped up, like he was sort of at the angle you would when you read a book in bed, with his mitre and like his red robes and like black shoes that he wore, and it was just really weird, and people would file past and just sort of take a look at his dead face and dead hands. And
I mean, to be fair, he looked dead for a long time before.
Well,
he,
that's what made me think, so was he, like, when did he actually die, Adam?
Well, yeah, exactly. Maybe he died when he was Pope, and that's why they decided to get a new Pope. We just didn't know.
This is the more, one of the more obscure conspiracy theories I think I've heard. So it's out there.
Yeah, the whole body thing is really odd. I went to the Vatican when I was, I'm showing my age now, but when John Paul II, the week that he died, we were just going there. It was in the half-term holidays. Like, that was very inconvenient for him because it really messed up our family holiday to Rome. and we couldn't go into the Sistine Chapel because they were doing the conclave.
Possibly his worst crime, I would say.
Possibly his worst crime is messing up our family holiday to Rome. Anyway, the point being is that my brother and I were absolutely obsessed by all of the dead popes in the Vatican. And I must have been maybe 9 or something, 9 or 10. And basically, underneath the altars, when you lift up the altars, they now have embalmed popes there, which are with like a wax mask on or something, because they run out of room in the crypt now. So what happens is when the next pope dies, they bring up the one who's been there in the longest. I think apart from St. Peter, because he just dust now. Anyway, they bring it up.
And also probably not St. Peter.
And probably not St. Peter. Yeah, exactly.
Well, also, he's not in the Vatican, is he, St. Peter? Isn't he? He's in a church nearby, I think, isn't
he? Oh, maybe. I don't know.
I mean, you know, who is traditionally considered to be St. Peter, I think, yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, the point being is that there are loads of embalmed bodies in the Vatican, and my brother and I got in trouble because we were checking underneath all the altars in the Vatican to see who we could see.
I honestly thought you were going to say under the robes, and I was like, I think it's probably a little bit late for the traditional check, the Pope is a man check.
No, it was underneath the altars. But yeah, so when the pictures of Benedict came out, I was just a bit obsessed with it because I think it's fascinating.
I am told that you are not meant to speak ill of the dead, but I mean, I'm not going to do that because as a podcast, I think we can categorise ourselves as not a big fan of the Pope Emeritus, a staunch opponent of liberation theology, which, yeah, already is going to put him in our bad books.
Well, he was a conservative figure, wasn't he? And so just inherently, he's not our guy.
Yeah.
You know, but as I was saying before we started recording, he's the Pope in the Catholic Church, and even the current Pope, who everyone seems to think is, you know, all fluffy and brilliant and all the rest of it, like, he is the Pope in the Roman Catholic Church. Like, yeah, he's done some cool stuff, he's put in some reforms, but, you know, there's still going to be a lot of stuff that, you know, if it was anyone else saying it, we'd be like, oh, that's really awful. But because it's the Pope and they've been such a conservative kind of force, you know, powerful force for so long, we're often willing to overlook all of that stuff because he says some nice stuff about the poor or whatever.
I mean, essentially, he's like, we shouldn't actively stone queer people. And it's like, well, that's pretty good because the bar is underground for a Pope. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Pope Benedict as well managed to cover up loads of instances of child abuse in the Catholic Church. So he was a pretty bad guy, really, all things considered.
Yeah, 100%. A long list of crimes and sins on that man's watch.
I feel like we should, just to keep ourselves safe, even though it would be happening from beyond the grave now, we should add an allegedly in for all of
that. No, I don't think it is allegedly anymore. I think it's pretty much, yeah. I think we don't even need to ask everyone that.
Well, I'm covering my own arse, allegedly. If you guys get sued, you know, you have fun with that.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Sue me, the ghost of the dead Pope. you covered up sex crimes. You are a terrible man. I hope it's hot where you are now.
Wow.
Let's talk about Pele, a much nicer man.
So Pele's coffin, where it's buried, is in like a 200-foot... fake asphalt area up in like a high-rise cemetery where there's a restaurant and there's I don't know if there's a spa or whether that I've made that up as wishful thinking, but there's basically like things that you can do while you're at the cemetery. And I love the fact that there's a replica football pitch that his coffin is going to be in or is in already, and then around it are just pictures of him throughout his football career. I just think it's amazing. Like, that's just bold, isn't it?
Even the dead need a few home comforts, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's great. It's like a proper shrine.
When I did the Camino a few years ago, they have things where all the coffins or ashes or whatever are stacked.
Why don't we do that in this country?
I don't know. We just want it out of sight, out of mind, don't we? Seems a bit too close to zombiedom.
Maybe, yeah. I think this country would do well with catacombs.
Why?
Well, I mean, it just saves on space, doesn't it?
Just burn them. It's fine.
Oh, yeah, I suppose you could do that as well.
We're Anglicans, we can do that.
Are you guys both pro-cremation then?
No.
We are.
I'm very clear on what's to happen to my body when it dies.
Yeah, go on.
All of my organs are to be harvested for people who need them, and then my skeleton is to be donated to a university department because it, you know, my medical conditions mean it's probably got some weird stuff going on the express condition that they refer to me exclusively as Dr. Bonesy.
Dr. Bonesy.
And if they don't do that, they can't have my skeleton.
That's
it.
Do you have to get a PhD for that?
It's different when you're dead.
Okay, cool.
More of a character, you know?
Yeah. I like that you're going to donate your organs. I regularly, like when I fill out a form, like for driving license or whatever, it obviously gives the opportunity to opt in to organ donation. And like, I want to do it, but I have some sort of real psychological block about it every time that I think is like, I think it's to do with genuinely that to tick yes is an acknowledgement of my own mortality, and I'm not really ready to face up to that. So I'm not actually on the organ donor register because I just can't, like, genuinely, every time I sit there and I'm like, just fucking tick it. Just tick it. And I can't do it.
I'm judging you, Ben.
No, well, this is the thing. I am putting this. This is my official legal consent for my organs to be donated. I can't tick the box for some reason, but please do donate my organs.
Is this your New Year's resolution? Like, if you die, then your organs get harvested.
You make it sound like I'm going to die this year.
I really like using the word harvested in relation to organ donation. I don't know why. It's just a slightly creepy, you know?
I think you're putting Ben off here.
No, I have no, like, I like, it's totally, like, I'll be dead. I've got no use of them. Absolutely, like, give them away. But it is just, like, it's the bit about me being dead that I don't like to acknowledge. And I can't put it into words, but just ticking that box is something I haven't been able to bring myself to do.
It's going to happen, Ben, sooner or later. It's going
to
happen.
Anyway, my therapy night is another night, so I'm going to talk to him about that and talk to you guys about a saint of the week, I think. Adam promises a theme. We didn't have one ready for last time, so we've got Lou's beautiful singing to accompany us. And Adam decided that was so beautiful that you have just created the theme by sticking those all together.
Saint of the week.
Yeah, I just took all three occasions of Lou singing Saint of the Week in the last episode, smushed together, and that's our theme now. You're welcome. Really hard work.
It's also really hard not to sing it whenever you say Saint of the Week. It's like everything in me is wanting to sing it.
Maybe we should allow you one last song of Saint of the Week.
I'll say it after you've done Saint of the Week, and then I'll just really prepare myself, you know, warm myself up.
We're not a podcast with a soundboard. We're not that tech savvy, so we just drop the themes in afterwards. So all three of us are now going to imagine the Saint of the Week theme tune in our head. Perfect, beautiful. And then you can say it now, Lou.
Saint of the week.
Beautiful. Adam, who is the saint of the week?
I was expecting a more operatic version, to be honest. that's okay. Saint of the week this week is Basil of Caesarea, also known as Saint Basil the Great. So again, another proper saint, even though this won't always be someone who is a proper saint recognized by multiple churches. Basil lived from 330 to 379, 1st or 2nd of January, depending on your, I don't know, what you prefer, I guess. anyway, he was Bishop of Caesarea, which is in Cappadocia, what is now modern-day Turkey, but was Asia Minor. He's one of the what we call Cappadocian fathers with Gregory of Nazianzus and Gregory of Nyssa. Gregory of Nyssa was his little brother. Gregory of Nazianzus was a friend.
Nepotism in the church started early on.
Well, literally, because Basil was appointed bishop. And then as bishop, he pretty much immediately appointed Gregory of Nyssa and Gregory of Nazianzus bishops as well. So, yeah, there was nepotism, which, you know, kind of made sense because, you know, we're going back to a time when they're trying to defend Nicene Christianity against what, you know, what they at the time and many today still consider heresies. And of course, they basically agreed with each other on all this stuff. So what do you do if you're having an argument about doctrine within the church that's a really big thing and you're a bishop? Well, you appoint those who agree with you, including your brother and your mate. There's some really good things about him, though. For one thing, he opposed slavery. Not that many big names in the patristic period did overtly oppose slavery, but he did. And he said some really cool stuff as well. So I'm going to read a fairly long quote to you, but it is all absolutely incredible. Fling wide your doors. Give your wealth free passage everywhere. As a great river flows by a thousand channels through fertile country, so let your wealth run through many conduits to the homes of the poor. Wells that are drawn from flow the better. Left unused, they go foul. Money kept standing idle is worthless, but moving and changing hands, it benefits the community and brings increase. I am wronging no one, you say. I am merely holding on to what is mine. What is yours? Who gave it to you so that you could bring it into life with you? Why, you are like a man who pinches a seat at the theatre at the expense of latecomers, claiming ownership of what was for common use. That's what the rich are like. Having seized what belongs to all, they claim it as their own on the basis of having got there first. Whereas if everyone took for himself enough to meet his immediate needs and released the rest for those in need of it, there would be no rich and no poor. Did you not come naked out of the womb? Will you not go naked back into the womb? So where did the wealth you now enjoy come from? If you say from nowhere, you deny God, ignore the Creator, are ungrateful to the giver. If you say from God, then explain why it was given to you. When a man strips another of his clothes, he is called a thief. Should not a man who has the power to clothe the naked, but does not do so, be called the same? The bread in your larder belongs to the hungry. The cloak in your wardrobe belongs to the naked. The shoes you allow to rot belong to the barefoot. The money in your vaults belongs to the destitute. You do injustice to every man whom you could help but do not. If you are rich, how can you remain so? If you cared for the poor, it would consume your wealth. When each one receives a little for one's needs, and when all owners distribute their means simultaneously for the care of the needy, no one will possess more than his neighbor. Yet it is plain that you have very many lands. Why? Because you have subordinated the relief and comfort of many to your convenience. And so, the more you abound in your riches, the more you are deficient in love.
Yeah. I mean...
Say another week.
Yes. Yeah. Can't argue with that.
That's pretty cool, I have to say.
To sound like a nerd, I always really loved patristics at university because...
No. This stuff...
Thank you. If you're just going to put the Simpsons thing in...
Yeah. Nerd!
That isn't very nice.
Marge, try to understand. As a jock, it is my duty to give nerds a hard time.
We have this idea of patristics as being this sort of dry, boring thing, just because it was from people writing and saying this stuff a long, long time ago. But it is absolutely shot through with this stuff. Like, so many patristic writers and theologians were saying this stuff and more. I really encourage people to go and find that stuff for themselves. That's not to say they all agreed with each other, because, you know, they don't. The sort of myth that the church, you know, if you take it back far enough, was all united and whatever is just nonsense. It was fragmented from the start. But this stuff has been in it from the very beginning.
Devil's lettuce is weed. What?
The devil's What's... lettuce is weed.
Yeah. Well, whatever you... Yeah. There's like a... The devil's brew. I don't know. There's some reference to alcohol. I've just got the tip of my brain, but I can't quite.
There's a devil something for everything, isn't there? There's devil's lettuce. There's devil's dandruff. You know, there's got to be one for booze as well.
Presumably, devil's urine. I don't know.
That's absolutely foul.
This is something I proposed, and it feels like a slightly odd topic, but I do think it's quite an interesting. I think there's a lot to be said about drinking and the kind of social role it plays and you know, how we think about it as socialists and as Christians. But I guess it's probably worth us talking about our kind of individual relationships to alcohol to start with very briefly. Adam, I believe that you are a non-drinker.
Yeah, no, I did drink at one point briefly. But I've never been a big drinker. And I think fairly quickly I realized, and this is, you know, one of those things where it's going to be like I'm saying this as if I've got, you know, a big head. I'm not saying it in that way, but I realized quite quickly that I could hold my drink and that scared me. And I stopped drinking when I was 20. And I haven't drunk ever since. Because I think there's something I always observed that, alcoholism is something that can really creep up on you.
Yeah.
You know, people have a little drink, maybe go out and have a big drink. And pretty soon when that's a part of your culture, and I don't just mean sort of broad kind of culture, but maybe your family culture or even your personal culture in a sense, it doesn't actually take too long before that is something that you're dependent on and reliant on. And I'm like, do you know what? I've already got enough things like that without adding another one. Yeah. And I think alcohol is really, really dangerous. And it's not that I would sit here and say, I think we should get rid of it, make it illegal, all the rest of it. No, it's ridiculous. I personally am for the legalization of all drugs. But I do think we have a relationship to alcohol, generally speaking, that is deeply unhealthy because we don't see it as a drug. In the same way that we see other drugs as drugs. And so we don't have a nuanced conversation about that or any other drug. And to me, I'm like, well, if I sit down and actually look at what individual drugs do and are and, you know, side effects and all that kind of thing, alcohol would be one that I would never touch. But not in the sort of tradition of like temperance movements or anything like that. I'm not moralizing about it. I just see a lot of damage done and a lot of creeping kind of addiction that leads to sort of huge damage done by it. So I don't entertain that personally.
I am also a non-drinker, but for significantly less pious and morally
conscious. Hey, I said it was not because of that.
Actually, this has been a really heavy year for me so far. I had one can of fruity cider on New Year's Day, which it was half of my total alcohol consumption last year. So it's been a heavy year so far. So I'm not a complete non-drinker, but I almost never drink. It's a very, very rare occasion that I do, but kind of just out of a lack of enjoyment. I was talking about this someone the other day, and they made the point, which I hadn't thought about, it makes a lot of sense, that a lot of neurodiverse people don't drink, particularly kind of with the autism aspect, because there's a sense of losing control, which I'd never thought about, but it makes a lot of sense.
I didn't say anything about that in my thing, but that is a big thing for me.
Yeah.
Always has been. It's the reason I've never, even when I did drink, I never got drunk.
Lou, are you a dirty sinner who drinks?
I am a dirty sinner who drinks.
Repent!
I'm so glad, because I did think to myself, I really don't want it to be three non-drinkers talking about how shit drinking is. Like,
well, as we've established, Ben, you're not a non-drinker, so...
No, you had a fruity cider on New Year's Day. So, yes, I am the dirty sinner who drinks out of the three of us. But I have had my own sort of complex relationship with alcohol. I think I started drinking quite young, really. And I come from a family of alcoholics. So I've kind of grown up with problem drinking around me. And so I guess I'm acutely aware of that. And that's made me question a lot of why I drink, and then also make me more aware of people who don't drink, but also the times that I need to not drink. So in that sense, that I guess kind of how I live my life, really. And I have an addictive personality, so I'm definitely aware of that. I did try going sober once, kind of, I guess, maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, and I lasted a year and a half. But what I ended up doing was obsessing about the not drinking, because it was something I wasn't doing, and then I was craving it more and more and more and more and more, and that itself became the kind of addictive thing. Whereas I felt that when I was drinking, I could take it or leave it a lot more.
Yeah.
So I kind of had to work out a sort of level of sobriety that worked for me, because going cold turkey did not work at all. So yeah, I go through periods of not drinking and then periods of drinking, and generally I would say my relationship is pretty standard, really. And I have a partner who doesn't drink, so I think if I had a partner who does drink, then I would probably drink more. But because I'm around a lot of people and my partner doesn't drink, I do definitely drink less, because for me it's very much a relational thing.
Yeah,
I think when you start to drink on your own, or when the times when I've started to drink on my own, that's when I get worried, and that's when I see the kind of cycle of alcoholism creep up, or my own fears about it.
I think it's interesting as well, Lou, like the experience you've described of periods of non-drinking and periods of kind of more normal levels of drinking is statistically an increasingly common experience. You know, obviously you've got right now people doing Dry January, and there was Stoptober, I think it was, and you know, but actually just more generally, you're seeing that in the UK there are people kind of, you know, in that 20 to 40 age bracket, people are going through periods of choosing to not drink, either for health benefits or simply because they, you know, want to sort their relationship with alcohol, but are then going back to drinking, but just kind of changing up their relationship with it a little bit. So rather than, you know, this clear distinction between people who drink and people who don't drink, there are more and more people who are having slightly more kind of varied and changing relationships with alcohol, which I think is really interesting, particularly alongside, you know, the statistics that show that younger people these days drink less than they have for 60 years comparatively. I'm interested to know what messages you guys heard growing up in church around alcohol.
I don't think I really heard anything, to be honest. I mean, I was kind of run of the mill Church of England, so I didn't really hear a lot, but alcohol was definitely part of something, like part of the community there, I suppose. And it's only relatively recently that I've heard in the church that I used to go to, people being more sensitive about not having alcohol out, or being more aware of it, perhaps. But when you go into the flower cupboard in my church, you know, you've got church wine glasses, church sherry glasses, church port glasses, that are just like there stacked up, and they're very rarely used. And often if there is an event, people tend to bring their own. But increasingly at special services and stuff, yeah, there's like, if there's an alcoholic option, there's always a alcohol-free option, and more often than not there is no alcohol option anymore. And I think rather than that just being a cost thing, I think that is also an awareness of the different experiences of people, and the need to not have alcohol present. But again, as I said, that's only been a relatively recent thing for me, rather than what I grew up with.
Yeah, I think for me, I was aware that there were churches that didn't have alcohol, because sometimes my grandparents would, so they were Anglican, but they would do like a coffee morning that I like to go to, because I was a weird kid. And that was at the Methodist church. So I knew of churches that didn't have alcohol, but it wasn't really till I was a teenager where I really engaged with that properly, because whilst I remained an Anglican, I did a lot of voluntary work with my local Salvation Army, and was really good friends with a lot of Salvationists who, of course, you know, abstain entirely from alcohol when they become members And so I learned a little bit about the you know, how that had come about and why and that kind of thing. And it made a lot of sense, but it was never something that was imposed on me personally, just something I sort of had a growing consciousness for. But other than that, in my church, there was no real message taught on that, I don't think.
That's really interesting, because I think perhaps because I was at a very youth-focused church, so the more kind of all-age church that I was part of, there was no real messages around that, and, you know, people did drink as part of their lives, and that was very normalised within that. But at the youth-focused church that I was part of, it was very... It wasn't necessarily that alcohol was a problem, but that alcohol led to, I mean, mostly it was that drinking would lead to having sex outside of marriage, like, you know.
Which is the most evil sin.
Well, yeah, exactly. Right? Like, that was, yeah, and it was, you know, teenage parties, you know, people would be drinking, and then they would, yeah, end up.
Yeah, alcohol is a gateway drug to sex.
Genuinely, that was the message that was being, like, communicated. Quite a few times I would go to a party and I would convince myself that I was, like doing a witness, like, genuinely, like, by my presence at the party. Like, that's how I justify that, yeah, that I was going to a party.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, and then as I got older, I was just like, nope, I'm going to get drunk and enjoy this.
Oh, that's how it starts. That's how it starts.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, the last thing you want is to enjoy things, right? That's always a dangerous road. Yeah. So, I don't know, it's been an interesting thing. And then I think as well, I think very clearly I saw in those church contexts that kind of class aspect of alcohol, in that underage drinking and, you know, getting drunk on a high street were, you know, awful things that, you know, definitely fell under the unacceptable side of things. But middle-aged people drinking in their homes, middle-aged and middle-class people, I should say, drinking in their homes, even if they actually drank more than the people that were getting drunk at teenage parties, that was a much more acceptable and classy thing to do. I think there's a classed element to, like, problem drinking is drinking that working-class people do a lot of the time, and that was really reaffirmed to me, you know, drinking 8 pints in an old man pub while playing some snooker or, you know, chatting to your friends about politics of the day or whatever is fine, but drinking 8 pints in your local Wetherspoons and then, you know, throwing up in the street is wrong. And I don't want to, you know, I mean, I have thrown up in the street in the past, but I don't want to pretend like that's a good thing.
Was that from alcohol or just generally just ill?
Once, no, but mostly yes.
I do definitely think though it is a class thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely. And certainly in terms of when you look at AA meetings or the makeup of AA meetings or why people ended up in AA or 12-step groups in themselves, there is definitely something that is seen as unacceptable when those who are drinking in the park or in a Wetherspoons or something like that, compared to drinking in your own home with a nice few bottles of red at a dinner party. And people don't see the second thing as a problem, and it's accepted and it's seen as normal. And that's how you behave at social events, that you have a lot of alcohol. But then when you're kind of going out and going to places where it's on the cheap or that kind of thing, then it is an issue. And I think that there's probably a lot of people who are middle class, maybe not identify themselves as middle class, but middle class going up to the kind of upper echelons of society, who are problem drinkers or are alcoholics. And because it's so much a part of the lifestyle, it's not seen as a problem or people don't recognise it in the same way. And maybe I'm talking maybe too much about my own kind of experience, because obviously that informs my thinking about this, but it's definitely a hidden issue.
I think it was really notable that alcohol-related deaths and binge drinking both went up during lockdowns. So although people weren't able to leave the house, actually, you know, and some of that was that people turned to booze to deal with it. I think it's also an acknowledgement that, you know, actually what we see in public displays of drinking, you know, there's antisocial behaviour and all that stuff going on. You know, I don't want to underplay that aspect of it. But, yeah, there's a certain... Maybe that is not actually as big a problem in terms of the health impacts, but it is simply more annoying if you're trying to have a nice evening out in the town.
Jesus weeps for Gaza. He sees the pain and suffering of the 1.9 million people who have been forced to leave their homes without access to nutritious food, clean water, decent shelter. He hears the cries of the 25,000 orphaned children. He is with all who mourn the 250 people killed every single day. Christians for Palestine UK is a group of Christians who are calling for an immediate ceasefire in Palestine. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but are united in our prayers, hope and action for equality, peace and justice for all the peoples of the Holy Land. Together, we are organising a Christian presence at the National Marches for Palestine and local Days of Action, where we've been joined by siblings from Sabeel Kairos, Pax Christi and a whole range of Christian churches. We urge you to join us to act in solidarity with the people of Palestine and call for a permanent ceasefire and just peace. The Very Reverend Canon Richard Sewell, Dean of St George's College in Jerusalem, says, "I warmly welcome the newly formed group, Christians for Palestine UK. Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank need to see the solidarity of Christians in the UK, and they will be encouraged to see your commitment to stand up for them in their time of terrible suffering." To find details of local actions or to join the Christian bloc at a national march, follow Christians for Palestine UK on Instagram and Facebook, or email christiansforpalestineuk@gmail.com. Join us as we call for a ceasefire now.
It's only antisocial behaviour, though, depending on the location. If you think about people in detached houses and the parties and various things like that and barbecues and all sorts, I mean, when does that become antisocial behaviour?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think it's interesting to talk about the role alcohol plays culturally. You know, even as a non-drinker, I am someone who quite enjoys a trip to the pub, and the pub has been this, you know, central thing in British kind of cultural life for some time. And actually it's something that is, pubs are struggling more and more. You see more and more pubs that have shut down or are looking for new landlords or owners. And, you know, there's this idea of the third place, which is a place that isn't home or work, where people can meet and socialise. And the pub was always really the central third place in British culture.
The community's living room, I've heard it called.
Yeah. So yeah, I think there was something, you know, not just to talk about alcohol as a social lubricant, which it is, and for those of us who are not always the most, I don't know, I know for me certainly that alcohol was for some time the way that I dealt with my social anxiety, and I know that that is an extremely common experience, and you know, the idea of Dutch courage, you know, where you get your courage up by drinking. You know, and that's the whole thing about the relationship between alcohol and sex, is that people lose their inhibitions and feel able to do and say things they wouldn't do when they were sober. But I think it's interesting to reflect on the fact it's not just that social lubricant, but also drinking places are social spaces, just generally in British culture.
I think just people don't have the money or the resources now in the same way that you can just enjoy a drink because it can be so expensive. But then I also wonder, on the flip side of that, pubs are generally warm social spaces, and maybe if that's the kind of,
yeah,
that might be a way for them to continue, those places that are embedded within the community. I was just, I mean, obviously, boo capitalism, boo big corporations, but originally when Costa was set up in the 1970s, that was a coffee shop that opened late into the evening for people that didn't want to go into pubs because alcohol was just too difficult for them. And I wonder how pubs can maybe adapt to the situation that we're in now. I mean, my partner, bless her, always gets in a right, like, gets pissed off when we go to the pub and then she wants a hot chocolate, but they don't have a coffee machine or somewhere to make a hot chocolate. Yeah, and she's like, I just want a hot drink. And she's like, I'll happily pay maybe a bit extra for a hot drink, but, you know, like, get one of those in and that'll be grand too. So maybe that's just a way that we have to adapt in time.
Yeah, and I mean, I think as well, like when talking about adapting and them being sort of that community space, a lot of the problem with it is that pubs more and more these days, because of the fact that so many of them being bought up or closed down or whatever, aren't spaces in the local community anymore, right? More and more you have to go into town or whatever to go and do whatever you're going to do, to go to the pub or go clubbing or whatever it is. Whereas, like, the pub was originally that kind of, like, community living room. It did have that kind of feel to it. But if we're closing down, and this is a problem, you know, a broader problem than that, right? Because more and more we're finding that the spaces where we buy and sell are just shifting to huge, to supermarkets or to shopping centers or whatever it is, to these huge places that absolutely destroy businesses that, you know, small businesses that exist in local communities. And that's the case across the board. You know, how many bakeries do you see? I mean, I was showing my girlfriend around my, you know, my neighborhood where I grew up recently when we went down to my parents for Christmas. And I was showing her these places and said, what is now a house used to be a bakery. This used to be a newsagent's. This used to be a little electronics shop. All of these places that are now bricked up and turned into houses because you can't make ends meet anymore. You can't be a small community bakery. You can't, you know, it's even harder now it's hard now to be, a community pub. Because so much of it is, you know, yes, cheap booze sold by supermarkets, but everything moved into a sort of central location rather than dispersed in communities.
We have to talk about Wetherspoons now, don't we?
Gross.
Oh, okay. This is going to be interesting because I have some quite conflicted feelings about Wetherspoons.
Same, actually.
In that the guy in charge of it, obviously a prick. And as you say, Adam, there's something about the, you know, they are essentially supermarket pubs. You know, they do the same sort of thing, and they are not rooted in the community in the way a traditional local pub would be. But there's also something about, I've spent an enormous amount of time in Wetherspoons, and I undoubtedly will continue to spend upsettingly large amounts of my life in a Wetherspoons for the foreseeable future, because the drinks are cheap and the food is cheap and kind of crap, but in a reliably 5 out of 10 meal sort of way. And I think it's something where it creates a space where particularly younger people and, you know, people who maybe are not that well off or, you know, don't have a lot of money to spare, you know, I'm thinking particularly people who are losing all their money on rent in major cities and stuff, or Wetherspoons is somewhere that everyone can probably afford to have a drink and maybe something to eat. And kind of be together, so it does create this social space, but at the same time, yeah, there's also the bad aspects of it as well.
I think it's just really sad that we talk about the cost of living, right? But actually, more than anything else, it's the cost of surviving. And if we have to resort to places like Wetherspoons in order to have a bit of social time and get a hot meal and maybe relax a little bit and not have to worry, that's, you know, that's about living, not just surviving. And the fact that that's now a luxury, or in order to get that, we have to kind of go for the places which politically or ethically are not great in the slightest. You know, what a sad state of affairs we're in. Because actually, if we're talking about living, that should be a normal part of our life, being able to have a relax, being able to stay warm, being able to have a drink if we want to. I think, like, I read a bit from President Lula's campaign speech when he got elected. Well, one of his campaign speeches when he got elected president in Brazil. And he talked about the right to grill some barbecue for our families at the weekend and buy a picanha with a nice piece of fat dipped in flour and a nice cool beer. And it's about those small glimmers of joy. And actually, they should be enshrined as rights for all of us.
Mm.
It's bread and roses again, isn't it?
It's bread and roses. It's totally bread and roses.
Yeah,
and
literally
and
where our podcast name comes from.
Is that where it comes from?
Yeah.
You know the... Are you taking the piss?
I hope you're taking the piss.
Yes, I'm taking the piss. Yeah.
But that, you know, that's basically what it all comes back down to again, isn't it? What we're living through at the moment is a cost of survival. Because people, when we're struggling, it's struggling to survive. It's not just struggling to live, because all of those things that we are taught are luxuries, they're not luxuries. They're glimmers of joy and glimmers of hope that keep us going.
I think it's important to say that Weatherspoons has a very, very, I don't say long history, but like a kind of gross and disgusting history, mostly because of, you know, Tim Martin. You know, they had a campaign... they backed a campaign against traveller and gypsy discrimination. They stopped homeless people going into their pubs. Obviously, they pay their staff absolutely disgustingly low wages. And whilst you go there, and I very occasionally will pop into one, you know, people do, and I don't expect that to stop. It's really important that we know what we're walking into when we walk into a Weatherspoons. I think it's really important that we talk about the church's history of alcohol as well. And obviously when we do that, we kind of have to start not just with the Eucharist, which is very important, but actually the fact that Christianity grew out of what became Judaism, right? And Judaism had an emphasis on the goodness of creation, actually, that Christianity also adopted. You know, that's a fairly core feature of Christian theology, is that God made the earth and saw that it was good. And so when Jewish responses to alcohol, I'm sure are as varied now as any other, as Christian responses or whatever. But actually a lot of that history with alcohol has been to understand that, you know, the fruits of the vine and the alcohol are good, but that one has to be very careful with it. Christianity had that understanding for a long time, with some sort of notable voices here and there that would sort of call that into question. It was particularly an issue with certain heresies in the first few centuries of Christianity. But where you really start to see a shift in belief and theology on this is in the sort of temperance movements that come about in the mostly in the 1800s, I think, but actually before that as well. And you see people like John Wesley, who was very anti-alcohol. I don't think there's any evidence to show that he, you know, I think basically he would have to use alcohol for the Eucharist. But he was also very clear that he did not drink. And that doesn't tell the entire story of Methodism's relationship with alcohol, but clearly it's an important starting point for that. So there's a number of, you know, different denominations, including Methodism, that have this, have their roots, some of their roots in this kind of temperance movement. And so much of that comes from the fact that there were huge social issues at the time with people going into bars, like spending the meager wages they got, men mostly spending the meager wages they got in bars, getting absolutely smashed on, I think it was gin mostly. Someone can correct me on that though, if I'm wrong. But of course, gin, you know, if it wasn't gin, it was a very hard liqueur.
It was gin. Gin has undergone a fascinating switch from being
the
middle class drink of choice. But yes, it was historically gin that was the most dangerous of the spirits.
Exactly. So you've got these temperance movements that Christians sort of started at this time that was largely a response to the social ills that this caused. And some people at the time suggesting you replace gin with beer in the pubs and bars. But some people, saying actually no, you should abstain entirely, that it's a deep sin not to. And so you've got some Christian denominations that even removed wine in the Eucharist and replaced it with grape juice.
One of the things people talk about a lot when it comes to kind of theology, Christianity, alcohol, is that Jesus' first kind of recorded miracle in the Gospels is at the wedding in Cana, and he essentially turns water into wine, as even the least Christian of our listeners is probably aware. But it's, after several days of celebration, they run out of wine, presumably because they've been cracking through a lot of wine, and he creates the best quality wine that you can find. And it's an interesting, that's kind of the big point when people have debates about alcohol, and people who are kind of more okay with drinking as Christians, and then people who are maybe in that temperance movement that you talked about, Adam. That is the big verse that comes up. I think it's one of those things where it's kind of it's a very famous verse and it's a bit overplayed. But for me, there's something kind of unavoidable about, Jesus announces his messiahness to the world by going to a party and getting people to drink more. Like, that is a statement of fact. And obviously, we maybe don't, I think it's fair to say, take a particularly literalist approach to the Bible. But if you are a biblical literalist, it's kind of hard to justify being a non-drinker. Certainly, or hard to justify that you shouldn't be a drinker because of your faith. And actually that, alcohol is pretty prominent throughout the Bible. Obviously we're talking about very different types of alcohol, a lot less strong, but it's interesting to think about. Actually, there was something kind of assumed about the status of alcohol within the cultures that the Bible emerges from.
And it's about that kind of understanding of the goodness of creation again, isn't it? And I think for me personally, it's not that I would say it is wrong or sinful to drink alcohol. It's just, I think the way we have it today in this society, in this culture, or our these sets of cultures, it's really destructive. I'm not sure that's necessarily the case, back then when Jesus is, turning water to wine. I think maybe it is possible to say, actually, it was easier back then to not allow that to be something that completely destroyed all your relationships and so on. As you say, with it potentially being not as strong and also not being commodified in the way that it is now. Capitalism has a lot to answer for generally, but one of the things that it really has to answer for is seeing and presenting things like alcohol as something that is A, you're really going to want, and B, is going to be something that you could kind of that can kind of soak up your problems, problems that are often created by living in a capitalist society. So I think it's important to acknowledge those different sets of circumstances, of context, and at that point I think it becomes a lot easier to say, well, it's not necessarily alcohol in and of itself that's the issue.
I think that's right. I don't have any more to say other than I agree with you, Adam.
One thing I was absolutely flabbergasted about when I first went to university was meeting lots of middle-class students and others who, as good Anglicans, were obsessed with gin. And I just found that very, very odd, because I didn't have that. My church back home was quite middle-class, but that wasn't something I'd ever come across before, but seems to be quite prevalent, especially in sort of more Catholic circles where I sort of found myself sometimes. And maybe then, you know, how do we even begin talking about that, sort of in the same direction that Lou was saying? You know, do we need to have a discussion about how we present alcohol, even if we do love gin? You know, maybe we don't go around saying, oh, gin is wonderful, and I'm you know, you could tell I'm Anglican because I drink gin or whatever, you know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I definitely see that in the Church of England culture, and maybe that's a kind of ordinand thing or clergy thing, or, you know, there's the whole thing about clergy malt club. You know, after midnight mass, everyone has a whiskey. And it went viral on Twitter, but I'm not on Twitter anymore, so I don't actually know if it's still a thing, but I expect, you know, I suspect it is.
I've never heard of that, but, by the way. I don't know what that is.
Oh, but. Right, okay. Well, anyway, it's such a middle class thing, isn't it? Like, everyone sharing their single malts, what they're having on midnight mass, like after midnight mass when they get back, before they have to get back up for an 8 a.m. BCP or something. Like, and I think as I've got older, it's just made me sort of more perhaps uncomfortable. And it's not to dismiss those people that do engage in it. And it's a nice, you know, like in lots of ways, it's a nice bonding thing. But actually it does maybe highlight that alcohol is quite an embedded part of our Anglican culture, or Anglican clergy culture. And probably need to have some conversations about that, really. Like, what does that mean? And what image is that presenting of us? It's really difficult though, isn't it? Like, because in lots of ways it's done as a nice bonding thing. Right, like, oh look, we've got to Christmas, isn't it amazing, isn't it fantastic, this is the way that we can bond and share together, and this is something mutual. But it does throw up questions of class and alcohol's use in that, and do we accidentally, without realizing, start doing it ourselves and become part of it ourselves? And then actually then it just becomes a culture because we're repeating it. And is that a bad thing or not?
It's the classic socialist thing, right? Where it's like, yes, I get this thing is really nice, but let me tell you about how it's terrible, actually.
Which is
one of the worst things about being a socialist is being like, cool, you like this thing, please allow me to ruin it for you.
But isn't it also the thing about how we create a culture by social media and by putting things online? Like, no one's going to know if you're having a whiskey after midnight mass unless you put it on Twitter or Facebook and hashtag clergy malt club. Yeah, yeah. So then it becomes like this cultural thing, doesn't it? That, yeah, oh, 100%. Well, I should like whiskey because that's what all of the other ordinands and curates and vicars and rectors are doing. But actually it's...
Yeah. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. We are back for the new year to do a run of episodes that will last however long we decide it lasts. I'm not making promises anymore. You'll get podcasts when they happen. You can find us in all your usual podcast feedy places. You can find us facebook.com/breadandrosaries, Twitter @bread_rosaries, and you can email us breadandrosaries@gmail.com. I am told that we should tell you to rate and review the podcast in podcast places. I don't know if that's a thing anymore, but do that. We are going to find some reviews of the podcast at some point and see if there's any fun or interesting ones there. So if you'd like to be featured on the podcast, the easiest way to do it is probably just email us. But if you want to review us on your podcast app, that'd be great. And we have a Patreon as well, because we spend money on putting this podcast out into the world, so no pressure at all. Everything will always be free, but if you would like to throw us some pennies towards the minimal costs of running a podcast, then we would be very grateful. Adam, where in the world can people find you?
You can find me most places at @commiexian.
Mm-hmm. And Lou is a mysterious entity who cannot be found anywhere in the world, not just online, just in general. Lou is actually a very sophisticated AI that we've added to the show.
That's true. That's where your Patreon comes in handy to keep me charged up.
Yeah. You think it's like hosting fees or whatever, but it's all about the AI money we're spending. Thank you very much, both of you, and we'll talk to you all next time.
See you later.
Bye.